you go beyond a 10-to-1 ratio of the power you're really putting in forward on the transmitter and the value of your slug. You're pushing your luck. If you push that ratio, you're going to damage a slug in general, because the slug has directivity, because there is a resistor inside that's supposed to absorb the power going in the wrong direction. That's what directivity is. And so when you're running 1500 watts, a hell of a lot of power is going into that slug's dummy load resistor in the reverse mode. And so be careful. Don't do that. You'll damage your slug, and after that, all your readings are suspect. That's a bunch of opinions. A bird watt meter properly used is a beautiful instrument. It's the gold standard. It's telling you all kinds of things that you need to know if you're smart enough to know how to use the readings. I once again will say, putting a bird watt meter after an antenna tuner is a perfectly valid thing to do. It tells you what is the standing wave ratio of your antenna. That's a valuable piece of information. K2LIW listening.
I agree with you, but also it's important to use the right slug for the right frequency range that you're measuring, or you're not reading accurate power output.
I certainly agree with that one also. And if your slug is rated for, let me pick a number, 150 to 500 megs, and you...
Repeater, timeout.
And you want to use it not at 500 megs, but 750. It's not the end of the world. It's going to read a little bit inaccurately. You could even calibrate it there. And why it has a particular frequency region, I can explain that one also. And so if you go outside of that frequency region, is it going to explode? No. It's going to give you readings that are somewhat reasonable? Yes. They're going to be 10% high, 10% low. But they're calibratable, and it is usable slightly outside of the frequency region. Now, don't take one at 500 to 1,000 megs reading, frequency reading, and use it at 500 KC. That would be crazy. That's pushing it too far. KE2EJ, K2IW, wait for the beeps, Eric.
Pulling loop size is different. Bye-bye.
K2RW, K2J. Just a quick note in terms of what broadcasters do. Because we have these taps that are mounted to the coax, we tend to use a power meter, which has its own correction factor depending upon the frequency, which is basically a thermocouple. You can't stick anything more than 0 dBm into it, or you blow up the front end. So, you know, on a multi-kilowatt transmitter, you'll have a tap that's maybe 35 or 40 dB down, and the meter itself will take that value of attenuation, and it will actually give you a correct reading in terms of power output based upon what it calculates, the heat that's generated within the thermocouple, which is way more accurate than a bird watt meter, but when you put one up against the other, they're really damn close.
And now we know why the bird is usually considered the gold standard. And for a reasonable number of dollars, you get an awful lot of accuracy. That fancy instrumentation you're using at the tens of kilowatt level on your broadcast transmitter, my guess is that particular kind of instrumentation is a little bit pricey, and we amateurs wouldn't be happy paying that purchase price, would we, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, if you call at $1,500 to $2,000 pricing for the average person, but then again, they'll spend $1,500 on a rig, so it's all relevant. But in terms of accuracy, now there's where you can get some real accuracy. But again, once you put it up against the analog meter, it's like, why'd you even buy the digital meter? So there you go. But when you do a proof of performance of a transmitter, the FCC wants to know what you use to make those measurements with. And they actually have a specification of how close it has to be. Either they want you to do it, actually they really want you to do it calimetrically, but they allow the thermocouple method as an accurate method. The calimetric method is a pain in the butt, but if you ever go into a good broadcast facility, you'll see thermometers that are sticking out of a hunk of coax, and you wonder what the heck it is, and that's what it is, especially if it's water jacketed, cool dummy load. K2RW, K2J.
In the case of the very high power transmitters on the B1B bomber program, at Airborne Instruments Laboratory. They had a number of calorimetric dummy loads, watt meters, and whatever. It literally was a very high-powered dummy load that it was so high in power you couldn't usually dissipate the power with air. You had water flowing through the dummy load, and you had thermocouples looking at the temperature of the input water and the temperature of the output water, and another device that was measuring how many gallons per minute were flowing through the dummy load, and the machine went through all those calculations, calorimetric calculations, so you could figure out how many watts was really coming out of that high-power transmitter. And so these Air Force transmitters can put out a fierce amount of power on the B-1B bomber program. The Navy transmitters on the EA-6B jammer pods, the standoff jammer program, they can put out a fierce amount of power. And so calorimetric water flow, water-cooled dummy loads are quite often used in order to test those transmitters. And one of those transmitters, let me drop quick. One of those Navy transmitters was being tested in a quick cutthroat technique inside an anechoic chamber. The transmitter put out so much power in an anechoic chamber that it took the foam absorber of the anechoic chamber, caught it on fire, and the whole damn chamber burned down. And if the fire department hadn't got there soon enough, the rest of the building could have burned down. And because that was a secure facility with a locked fence around it, and the guard couldn't find the key to that lock fast enough to get the fire department in there, they were coming close to the point of plowing through the fence with their fire truck in order to try to save the building and any of the people that are in the building. So you can pull out enough power out of a high-power Department of Defense transmitter, Navy or Air Force, which can take anechoic foam, the absorber in an anechoic chamber, catch it on fire, and after that you're in big trouble. Let me drop. Because the chamber with this urethane foam absorber is not only burning furiously, but it's the urethane foam, when it burns, puts out a cyanide-bearing gas, which is dangerous. The firemen fighting that fire, some of those firemen got very sick. And can you put a sprinkler system into an anechoic chamber without disturbing its RF characteristics? There's a big compromise going on there as to how you protect a chamber. You can protect it with a certain kind of freon, I forget what the stuff is called. What was that again?
Halon.
Yeah, halon. But halon is now considered a chlorofluorocarbon, which disturbs the ozone layer of the ionosphere. Even though it's the world's best fire retardant, which is safe for human beings to some degree, we're not allowed to use it in chambers anymore. So
it displaces oxygen, so it's not safe for humans.
You can breathe halon as long as it's not a huge concentration of halon compared to the oxygen, and it doesn't damage people, so it is quasi-safe for humans.
K2IS info.
Go ahead, Bill. AC2IS, K2IW. Tell us what you know about halon, and I know they've been looking for a substitute, and boy, they're having a dog of a problem trying to find a substitute. You've got it, Bill.
What's currently used in, I think, most fire suppression systems that displace oxygen from the room is called FM200. Halon is actually safe to breathe in as long as you do get enough oxygen to not pass out. And, you know, once the halon is out of your lungs, pretty much you're unaffected by it. AC2IS.
As a fire suppressor, halon was beautiful. Is the FM200 not quite as good, but it's at least not a chlorofluorocarbon, so we're allowed to use it? Is that what's approximately going on, Bill? And hopefully this stuff is not hugely expensive. AC2IS, K2LIW. You sound good tonight.
I believe that FM200 systems are expensive. I think that on a large scale, halon was also kind of expensive. I'm guessing that FM200 is slightly less effective. Otherwise, I'm guessing that they would have used FM200 systems in place of halon without it becoming a regulatory issue. Sorry, I don't have numbers on the exact effectiveness of FM200 versus halon. I just know that FM200 is very commonly used in places in applications where halon had been in the past. AC2IS.
appreciate your adjustment.
Okay, I'm going to turn it over to Eric in a second. And Eric, I wonder, for the installations that used to be equipped with Halon, is there a grandfather clause where you're allowed to keep using that installation with the Halon, or must you rip out all the Halon and go over to FM 200? KE2EJ, wait for the beep, K2LIW.
As far as I know, all Halon systems that I'm aware of have been replaced with FM 200, which is actually heptafluoropropane. It's still a fluorocarbon, but it doesn't have the chlorine. That's not the reason. They say it works pretty much about Halon. It does displace oxygen in the same way. And that's what they're using these days.
Okay, that's very good to know. Now, alrighty, I think we've gone down the list of people who signed in. I think we've handled them all. And if John is available, we'll go over to the mailbag at this time. KC2WGB, K2LAW. Go ahead, John. Yeah, possibly John is not available tonight. The first time in a zillion years. Okay, then we'll switch things around a little bit and go over to the SpaceNet. Paul, WS2N. I've been reading, let's see now. I'm trying to remember. I've read about some other spacecraft that are about to be launched. I've read about some other failures. I saw a nice YouTube video about the astronaut who went up there, who is an exact twin, who went up for almost a year. I think he went up for 340 days. As soon as he got onto the International Space Station, the next Progress ship that was supposed to come up, it didn't make it. And then there was a Japanese supply ship that didn't make it. Two in a row. And people were making jokes as to whether or not he was jinxing the International Space Station. So I saw some YouTube videos about that. So things were getting a little bit touch and go there for a while. NWS2N, K2LIW, and you're ready for Space Report number 231. You got it, Paul.
FYI, John's not logged into Echolink, which means he's not there.
Okay, good to know. And I'll be calling him on the twisted pair a little bit later. I'm a little concerned. WS2N, K2LIW. Go ahead, John. Paul.
This is WS2N. Very good. If John's not there, that's not a good sign. John is always there. And, the fellow you were talking about was Pat Kelly. He was there for a year. And his counterpart was Mikhail Novikov. Get his last name. But they were both up a year. Almost a year. It was 12 months, but they didn't complete a whole year. Got close to it. Three cargo ships were delayed during their flight. The Progress one that was lost and went out of control after separating from the third stage. That was followed by orbital ATK. That was lost. That was supposed to go up to the space station. That had the Cygnus cargo on board, and that was the second one. The third one was SpaceX CRS-7 had gone up and exploded midair. The helium let go and blew up the second stage. So that was quite an adventure. So they still had stuff up there. They still had four months supply. So they weren't going to run out anytime soon. And then eventually the Japanese HCV got up to them and resupplied them. And then they had two flights from orbital ATK. They, instead of launching on the Antares rocket, which they lost when it launched from the the pad in Virginia. They made a contract with ULA and signed up for last December and then March, a couple of months later. They launched on an Atlas V. They encapsulated their Satan Cygnus spacecraft in there, a completely different rocket, and successfully went to the space station. Since then, everything was going good. Up until recently, a week and a half ago, the Progress cargo ship was going up to the space station. And now that problem is after it separated from the third stage. It wasn't high enough and it deorbited. But that now has happened after Scott Kelly has come back. You know, he's long come back, probably 4 or 5 months, probably about 6 months now. Since then, a couple of other Americans have gone up. Let me drop it. And you're right, he was a twin. He had a brother, also an astronaut. They both were pilots and flew the space shuttle, commanded the space shuttle at different times. But his brother, since then, has, let's see, Scott Kelly was the one on board, and his brother was, Mark Kelly was retired a little bit before that. He was the one married to Gabby Giffen, the congresswoman that got shot in Arizona. And soon after that, the husband, he did make one flight after that, and then he retired. And now the other guy packed it in. They're both retired now. That was his final flight. Speaking of older flights, let me drop it. We lost John Glenn. He died at 95 years old. Unfortunately, but he was born in the early 1920s. And he, of course, was one of the original seven astronauts and the first fellow from America to fly in orbit. And, of course, that kind of haunted him. He always wanted to go back up to space. Kennedy didn't want to take a chance and send him up and accidentally kill an American hero. But he pushed and pushed and pushed, and sure enough, at 77 years old, he did go back up on Discovery, Space Shuttle Discovery. So he did get a second flight out of that at 77 years old. But, shame that he's gone, but he was the last of the final original seven astronauts that were chosen for Mercury. This is WS2M. Let me drop it. So, talking about the Progress failing a week or so ago, the Russians have had another cargo spacecraft being developed, and they think that this might accelerate that program. So it's going to be a little larger than the original one. It's going to be able to carry more stuff, a little over a ton more of cargo. So instead of, let's say, 6,000, it will be probably able to carry up to almost 8,000 pounds. And it's called the Increased Capacity Cargo Transportation Spacecraft. I'm sure it'll probably come up with a different name by the time that starts flying in 2020. But it was going to be probably 21, 22. I think they might accelerate that. They've had some problems with the Progress, as well as the Soyuz spacecraft, which, is running. And lately they've had some problems. So, I hope they get their act together, but I hope before that all happens, we in America get our two spacecraft flying, the one from Boeing, CRS 100, now called the Starliner, which will eventually fly four people up to the space station, and the Dragon cargo vehicle, again with four people.
Again.
Planned on resupplying this space station with that, and they will both fly out of Florida. So that will be pretty exciting once they get that going. The earliest possible flight I see would be maybe a test flight at the end of next year, 2017, and maybe regular flights starting in 2018. So we'll see. Maybe they can get more money budgeted for the manned space program and accelerate that a little bit. Hopefully it doesn't go any other direction. Another program, it looks like it's canceled from what I've been reading. I haven't read it on enough websites or magazines, but the Lynx rocket, really a space plane being developed by X-Corps. I haven't seen much about that in the last year. And then recently I read an article or two. It looks like they've stopped developing that suborbital space plane. Plans were to take just one person, put it on board, and fly it up to the Kármán line, 100 kilometers, just in space, 62 miles, and then come back and land. And for that, you would have paid, I remember they said originally $80,000, and I think it was up to $100,000 for that seat. You want a pilot. But looks like that has come to an end from what I've been reading. The company is still developing rockets. They plan on developing the rockets for probably for NASA.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
That leaves us with two suborbital companies that we could always go on, and that would be Blue Origin with the new Shepard. They're still developing that. The one that they flew five times successfully, went up into space, came back and landed vertically. They've retired that one. They've gone as far as doing an abort test with the spacecraft that would normally carry people separated properly and came back down on parachutes. So next time that they fly that will be another new Shepard that they're building. And that will be the one that will eventually carry not only pilots but passengers. Again, it will go up into space past the Kármán line and come back and land. And they plan on flying out of New Mexico. They're testing these things in Texas, but I think they plan on eventually launching into Mexico. That would be pretty cool. And then the other company is Virgin Galactic, and they're now developing another, let's call that one a space plane, that will take off on a runway and go again into space for a suborbital flight with up to six passengers, I believe, on board, plus pilot and co-pilot. And that would return and land on a runway. And now a week or two ago, they tested that new rocket plane out. It's called Unity, by the way. The first one that they had a year and a half ago was called Enterprise, and that was one that crashed accidentally. Killed one of the pilots that were on board. The other one successfully parachuted, although he injured himself, but at least he made it back. So they built this new one called Unity, and it looks exactly like the old one, except it's got certain safeguards in it, where the same thing that happened to the first one might not happen with the second one. They did run a test. They dropped that from White Knight 2. White Knight 2 is a carrier, and they're going to, the idea is to drop this thing from a carrier and have it go into space. Right now, it takes off on a runway, the carrier with the Unity spacecraft, and then when it gets up to height, the plan is to drop it, and then it would ignite its engines and go into space. Right now, they haven't fired the engines yet. They just, first time a week or two ago, they just dropped it from the carrier, and they landed it on the runway. So they're getting there. The first one that they had a year and a half ago, they killed that one guy. They had four tests with a rocket. And the fourth test is the one that ended in a disaster. They haven't gotten up to the rocket stage yet with this new one. We'll see how Virgin Galactic does. That's pretty much it for suborbital flights. There's plenty of orbital things coming up, but many years down the road, probably 4 or 5 years down the road, so we won't talk much about it, about that until they get that developed. For instance, Blue Origin, one that's developing, New Shepard is developing a rocket called the New Glenn, and named after John Glenn, and that will be an orbital flight. He plans on putting passengers on that probably in 2020. So, a lot of flights went up last week. I talked about one that I wanted to see that I did see on last Friday morning. That was the flight by Japan sending the cargo up to the space station. It sent about 10,000 pounds up. Hasn't gotten there yet. It's a 4-day flight to the space station for them. But that went up 8:30, around 8:25, I think, on Friday morning. And they got off the ground okay with the, you know, rocket from Japan. They use a H-2B rocket to do that, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket. And that made it into orbit. So that will get to the space station Tuesday morning. They'll grab it with the robot arm and birth it to one of the docking ports, the berthing ports. And then a couple other flights last week. December was very busy. One from China, another one from Arian Space. They launched a Vega rocket. There's one right after the other. So there's a lot of things taking off in the month of December. But that was the main one. There was also another big one that Atlas V launched for the military. And that was successfully done from Cape Canaveral early last week as well. Then that went up on a Delta IV rocket, not an Atlas. Delta IV rocket. So, which is a little bit more horsepower. Dick, back to you for questions. We have plenty more to do, but can't cover everything. K2RIW, WS2F.
I have a question, K2JX.
Go right ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I don't know if this is true or not. I heard a news report while I was in Hawaii that the new president-elect wants to either reduce funding or defund NASA. Have you heard anything about that, Paul?
There's always been talk that if the Republicans got back in, they would try to reduce funding primarily for climatic type of global warming type of satellites. They would increase the human flight program, the manned flight program. But a lot of these satellites that are going up, I wouldn't be surprised if they get some of them start getting defunded. There's so many of them. And then there's talk about not necessarily defunding them completely, just transferring over to NOAA and let NOAA handle it. And NOAA has their own budget, and which would be okay because you're just transferring the money. And just a different department would be handling it. But they would like NASA to continue with exploration, robotic missions to Jupiter and the Europa and things like that, I think would continue. But, like, we have a satellite going up, eight of them being launched at one time. I'll have to check next week coming up. Let me drop it. K2YO. Okay, stand by, K2YO. But these eight satellites are going to be launched by a Pegasus rocket not from California. Usually the Pegasus goes off from Vandenberg or Kwajalein Island on the Pacific. But Pegasus is going to be going up from Florida. And it's got these eight, they're called Cygnus spacecraft, but it's not the same cargo. It's spelled differently. And these Cygnus craft are going to be flying in line one after the other, eight of them from one rocket. And they're going to be looking at hurricanes, that type of thing. I wouldn't be surprised if that starts to get defunded, but it's a valuable mission because they will really be able to detect wind speeds in real time instead of waiting, you know, sometimes half a day or another whole day before they get another report from some of the existing satellites. And the ones that we have aren't going to be anywhere near as accurate as these things. Dick, I know another station was coming in. Let me pass back to you, Dick.
Bernie, K2YO, wait for the beeps, and you've got it, Bernie.
Hey, gentlemen. I was curious along the same lines that Eric's question is, and I inquired. I work in the aerospace industry and let's just say the commercial side, and I asked some questions, and the answer was that the ULA folks do not feel any concern about who the new president or who the president-elect is, and don't see any changes in their funding. So that's just from the, shall we say, the commercial launch end.
Bernie, you talked about the ULA folks. Want to tell us what those letters stand for? I guess Universal Launch Alliance, is that what it is?
Affirmative. Basically the group which is owned by all the aerospace companies, so that they use common parts, common rockets, common lifting bodies, etc.
Go ahead for any further information on that. Call WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, Bernie's right. About 10 years ago they started ULA, United Launch Alliance, by Boeing and Lockheed. It's really their companies, part of their companies, were joined together to create United Launch Alliance. So they had launched the Delta IIs, which are, I think there's only one or two more planned for them. Delta IVs, Delta IV Heavies, Alpha 5s, and eventually we'll be launching the new Vulcan rockets that they have planned in about 3 or 4 or 5 years. Vulcans eventually replacing the Delta IVs with the Vulcan rockets. So we'll see. I'm not seeing much of a change so far. So, but I know they're not crazy about global warming type of satellites. And even with that, they might transfer them over. Don't forget, there's another space program really involved. The military, more money that goes to the military base and the than what this has. Right now, we have a space plane flying around up in orbit for last year, called the X-37B. And that has nothing to do with NASA whatsoever. And I think this is their fourth mission since 2010. And they think nothing about keeping this thing up there a year or so before they bring it back and land it in Vandenberg Air Force Base. Unmanned.
Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Back to you, Dick. Any questions?
Yeah, Eric maybe has some further questions. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
No, I think that pretty much got covered. It'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, interestingly enough, I don't even remember who it was, but they asked the Department of Energy or the Department of Environmental Protection who the lower workers were that were involved in global warming research. So it seems like the global warming deniers are winning the world.
I thought there was a survey recently that 90-some-odd% of the well-educated, respected, qualified scientists believe that man-made global warming is a reality. Am I even close to the numbers that are being believed along those lines? Over to you, Eric.
Something like that. Interestingly enough, if you go back to the 1950s when Bell Labs used to make the science film, I think there was a segment of I, Mr. Sun with, what's his name? I'm trying to think of the doctor's name. And then they had the actor with him, where they showed the pollution coming out of the cars and how it goes into the atmosphere and what's going to happen in 20 or 30 years. So it's not a new thing.
Last week, Eric, I think you were in Hawaii, which I think is something like 7 or 8 time zones away from us, and you were talking back to us on Echolink or IOLP, and you sounded very good. What was your means of talking back to us when you were in Hawaii? Back to you, Eric.
No, I actually had 3 different ways to go, but I chose one night it was Echolink, and the other night it was IOLP. So I used both systems that we had.
And each of those systems, you were talking into what kind of an instrument that was tuned to what frequency or dialed to what number? And I think you have a family relative in Hawaii. Is that one of the reasons you were there? As well as a good vacation. Go ahead.
No, I think this is like a 13th or 14th trip there. We have a lot of friends spread out all over the island. We have some friends on the Big Island, and one guy who does all of Peter Jackson's animation and stuff like that, he lives on Oahu. And he works for the University of Hawaii. And that's also where the PBS station is. I get to visit my friend Steve there, who's the chief engineer. So by Echolink, I use my cell phone, and via IOLP, I use my HT, talking to the repeater on top of Haleakala, making its way back here.
You've been to Hawaii quite a number of times now, and you know what life is like there. Would you like to live there? The good news is it's got some beautiful weather, nice conditions, very predictable from day to day to some degree. The bad news is everything you want from the real world has to be shipped to you because you are an island thousands of miles away from the mainland of the United States. So if you had your choice and you were a rich person, would you choose to live there, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Now, 20 years ago, we put down a few bucks on a piece of land. We have, we're still trying to decide whether we're going to retire there or retire in Florida where we have another piece of property which is just being rented. Makes, that's pretty good way to pay for it, so it doesn't make any kind of profit. But, we go back and forth on it all the time. If you live there and you're not in the touristy place, if you go, like, if you choose Maui, let me let it drop. If you choose to live on an island like Maui, which is really nice, there is actually a very highly technical center in Kihei, where they have supercomputers and stuff like that, and also at the top of the mountain, you've got all those observatories. If you stay away from West Maui, which is sort of a touristy area, where the prices of everything is truly inflated, but if you go to places like Kula or Makaua or Paia, you can live there at a pretty reasonable cost without, straining too much. Actually, if you choose the right place, normally go out in the backyard, pick your food, and come back in and eat. Oahu tends to be terribly expensive unless you go to the north side of the island. And by the way, When you need stuff like electronic components and things like that, you go to Oahu and you go to Honolulu. You can find just about anything you need. It's kind of like New York in that respect. So, the Big Island is a whole different story. It depends upon where you choose to live. And by the way, right now it's like forever raining there. So, K2RIW, K2J.
It's forever raining there. Does that mean this is their rainy season? Or is there something unusual with the weather going on at this time? That's question number one. And if I was on one of the islands in Hawaii, and I wanted to go out and buy 100 feet of Rhone 55 tower, made by Unaka Rhone, as it used to be made, getting it shipped there, my guess is, could be a little pricey. K2EJ, K2IW.
No, I suppose that's relative. Actually, I don't know if you can buy your own tower there, but there's places where you can actually get towers in Oahu. But let's put it this way. Let's say you drove to California and you had your van and you stuffed it with all your stuff and you put it on a boat, about $450 later, it'll land at the island that you choose. So in one respect, it's really not that expensive, but in another respect, yeah. Everything you want that isn't there, got to get there by some method. And FedEx isn't cheap either.
Yeah, are they having unusual weather at this time, Eric, or is this a normal rainy season?
Well, from what I get from everybody, it's rather unusual. Rainy season really doesn't start until like February, March. And also, it's different on each island, by the way. It, you know, they aren't all clustered together. Whereas Kauai is known as the Garden Island, it has a more moderate temperature. But interestingly enough, that island itself has 36 microclimates. And by the way, WWVH is in Waimea Canyon. So it's sort of like a mini Grand Canyon on the north side of the island. It's really cool.
That many climates. Wow. And Hawaii almost never gets a hurricane. But haven't they had one recently, which is very unusual? Go ahead.
Unusual, no. Well, at least unusual to actually hit the island, but they approach the island pretty often. Actually, one way, I think it was about 12 years ago, just about every roof on the island of Kauai had to be replaced. And I forget the name of the stone, but it was a good one.
El Nino or La Nina affects the Pacific Ocean region. Those La Nina or El Nino cycles, does that create a cyclic weather condition in Hawaii that you know of, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, we know the effects of both are global. Whether it affects Hawaii specifically, I'm sure in some fashion it does. Very interesting thing about Hawaii now, because of the way the islands are laid out, was we were on Maui, and that's where they were complaining it was raining forever. Although when we got there, the rain stopped. There were a lot of nice pieces of rainbows. You get really nice rainbows there, and quite often. Sometimes when it rains, it's just like a little spritzel, not even a drop. It's just sort of like a spray. The water droplets are very fine. But while that was happening on Maui, Oahu was perfectly dry. So, you know, and the climate's different from island to island. The Big Island, which has the active volcanoes on it, is warmer. It's further south, but it's warmer, and I don't know how to describe it. It's more of a rock, so to speak. K2RIW, K2J.
And all of those islands are basically plate tectonics. Two plates are coming together in that area. And I think those islands are strictly volcanic in origin. In other words, these literally are mountains sticking up from the floor of the Pacific Ocean. Is that approximately what those islands are, Eric? Go ahead.
No, that's precisely correct. If you were to measure Mauna Kea from its base to its tip, it's even higher than Mount Everest. Interesting little note. They were going to build an observatory. I don't remember which university it was. on a particular area of Mauna Kea, and that project got stopped because they found out that it was an ancient burial bone. The natives put up a big fight with that one. The islands grow, and actually the Big Island grows something like 4 feet every year because the vents that actually, if you look at the south side of the Big Island where the Black Rock is, which is actually the black sand beaches, that part of the island grows about 4 to 6 feet every year, and the entire chain of islands are on a plate, and they're constantly moving northward on X number of inches a year. I don't remember exactly what the number is.
So from some point of view, the newest pieces of land on planet Earth are in the vicinity of Hawaii. Do they make claims like that, Eric? Go ahead.
Oh, I don't know if they phrase it that way, but essentially, yeah. Interestingly enough, we have some friends that live in Pahoa, which is not far from Kilauea, which is the active volcano. And that's the place where the lava comes every now and then and just stops. It actually almost made it up to the main street this last flow. But we have a friend who is a kahuna, and he is in the middle of the big flow, I think, in 86 or 90-something. And the lava just about covered everything for miles around, but they left his house and his front yard and his trees and everything else standing. Didn't touch it. It was quite weird. And he's a guy who will actually take you to where the lava is flowing. And we have a friend who takes like 8 meters and dips it in the lava and makes art out of it.
When that mountain is erupting and issuing a whole lot of lava and it's flowing, and if it happens to be starting to flow toward your town, across your street, near your house, I'm getting the impression there's approximately no force on Earth that can divert it or stop it. I guess you could put up a hill of dirt and divert it a little bit. I'm guessing not very much. I'm guessing the mountain really decides where that lava is going to go, and mankind has to sort of tolerate it. Is that approximately true, Eric? Did you LIW?
Yeah, well, over the years, they've done a lot of different experiments trying to divert lava flow, and I don't think any of it's been successful. The stuff is hot. The stuff is molten rock. It moves slowly. It's very creepy. It's very strange. And actually, as it hardens on top, you can literally step on it, but you have to be careful because you can actually go right through it. I got a lot of pictures of moving lava up close with... I even took a cheap camera, and unfortunately the lens melted on it. It was so hot, but it's interesting stuff, but the people there live with it. Actually, in Pahoa, they have a man-made lake, which is sort of, I guess it's about 102 degrees or 101 degrees, and it's, you know, it takes the heat of the earth, literally, to keep that water warm from warm. And by the way, they have these lava tubes which run out to the ocean. If you ever look at any pictures of the Big Island, you'll see at the south end of it, you'll see steam coming up, and that's where the lava is literally dumping itself into the water and getting cooled and making steam and making the island bigger.
Are most of the islands somewhat temperature stable, Eric? In other words, if I decided I like 80 degrees Fahrenheit and 80% humidity, is that the kind of weather I would have a lot of days of the year on the islands? Go ahead.
Well, consider this. They're not on the equator, but they're closer to the equator. It's the most southern part of the United States, actually. The weather tends to be... the weather tends to be very consistent. It never really depends on which island, too. And we're talking at sea level here because the islands have mountains, like Haleakala is a now defunct volcano. And as soon as you start to go up, of course, the temperature drops. But if we're talking at the at sea level, it never really gets lower than like 60 and doesn't really get higher than 90. And the humidity tends to run between 30 and 60%. It's not oppressive like you can get in Florida. And when it is humid, it's not really uncomfortable. It's pretty consistent. That's the interesting part of it. And also, because you're... I'm going to let it drop again. Because you're close to the equator, sunrise and sunset stay pretty much close to each other throughout the year. So everybody's up and at them at 6 a.m. when it's bright and sunny. They kill everything in terms of work and stuff like that. It's like 3, 4 o'clock, and at 6 o'clock it's dark.
Of course, on top of those mountains, they've got some beautiful optical astronomy observatories. And you're getting up above a whole lot of the atmosphere. Down at sea level where you were, are they pretty good at controlling flare lights, street lights, parking lot lights, and so on and so on? At midnight, when you look at the sky, are you seeing a reasonably clear sky many times a year? Is an amateur astronomer at sea level somewhat happy in Hawaii, from what you can tell, Eric, KE2EJ, K2RIW?
All right, if you're on the Big Island, that's sort of your astronomer's paradise, which you can also do that on Maui, in Haleakala, but the Big Island is really the place to go because it's a 9,000-foot level, it's a visitor center. And every night, there's a big Celestron, I think it's a 16-inch out there, and astronomers have come down from the 15,000-foot level to do demonstrations and point things out, but the beauty of it, even at the 9,000-foot level, when you look up, you can see the Milky Way with your eyeballs. You can see the gases glowing in the sky. Depending on, you can see that with French owls, too. But the interesting part about the island is there generally is a layer of clouds that's like 7,000 feet, 6,000 feet, and it tends to mute the glow that comes from below. And there's a certain amount of incident light that shows up. Depends on the weather conditions, but it doesn't seem to bother anybody up there.
So I think you're telling me that when you looked up in the sky at nighttime to look at the Milky Way, there were very few places you know of that you've gone to, which gives you a better view. Go ahead.
I suppose the only place that really gives you the better view is that hill in Chile. But even in France, when we were in the French Alps, I mean, you could just sit out there at night. I even took a camera and just laid it on the ground, opened and shut it, and got some really interesting images. But you can literally see the Milky Way glowing. It's eerie. It's just an amazing line in the sky. If you've never seen it, I mean, it's breathtaking.
And the poor people in New York City have never seen that. Now, when it comes to Eric talking about Hawaii, Eric talking about his broadcast experience, and Paul talking about the space report. If anybody within the sound of my voice has any further questions on that or anything else we've discussed tonight, give me a call, let us a name, right now. K2RIW listening.
N2NBR.
N2NBR. Sounds like November Bravo Ramwheel. Thought of your name, sir. And then proceed with your question or comment.
Okay, Dick. Hamlin here is John, QTH, is Northern Westchester. As relates to your discussion concerning the bird model 43, I just jumped on my computer and for a little bit of effort here, you get about 24 pages worth of instruction manual. There's a gentleman, a presumably very nice gentleman, known as K4XL. Followed by BAMA. I don't know what he means by that, but anyway, it's a free of charge boat anchor type manual archive service, and just dial that up, and I think you can get a couple of dozen pages, and it explains a lot of stuff. Back to you, Dick.
Hi, thank you, John. From, I think you said Northern Westchester. Good information. I know that I had a Bird 43, didn't own an owner's manual. Went on Google and did a search. It seemed to me like in a very short period of time, I found a place that would download a manual for me. I believed I was getting it from Bird itself, but there I'm not sure. Anyhow, getting the owner's manual is fairly easy. and with all the charts and graphs and methods of operation they described to you, putting it on the output side of the antenna tuner. If you're smart enough, it's a very logical thing to do. It can give you an exact reading of the real standing wave ratio of your antenna. The confusing thing that a lot of people don't realize is that when you're using your antenna correctly, your transmitter sees no standing wave ratio. It sees essentially 1:1, which you could say you'd like to know what is the SWR of your antenna, because it's a big factor giving you some extra loss of your transmission line. And it also gives you a way of knowing whether or not the antenna is degrading and is there anything that you should be repairing. Let me drop this. So knowing your antenna standing wave ratio is a valuable piece of information, and your antenna tuner is essentially wiping that out for you on the input end. That's what this intent is to do. But to know what it is on the output side is a good thing to know, as we finally discussed tonight. And at first there was some controversy as to whether or not you can put a bird there. There are smart people at the laboratory of the American Radio Relay League who have written articles in their magazine telling you you cannot trust the readings of a bird watt meter when you use it on the output end of the antenna tuner, or you cannot trust the readings of the bird watt meter if your antenna has a moderately high standing wave ratio. Well, I strongly disagree with that opinion. The whole reason using the bird watt meter is first of all, to find out if your transmitter putting out the right power, and the next thing is it'll tell you what is the standing wave ratio on that chunk of line where you installed it. So it's perfectly logical to put it in essentially any piece of coax cable, even a 70 ohm coax cable. You gotta be careful how you interpret the results, but if you know what you're looking at, it's telling you a very exact truth that is traceable to the Bureau of Standards. So I thank you for that info. I'll pass it back to you, John, if you want to give us any further info. And I bet you won't.
K-C-2-Z-U-M.
ZM recognized, get you in a second.
K-C-2-Z-U-M.
Z-U-M recognized, we'll get you in a second. Now, first, John, N2NBR, I bet you you've owned some bird watt meters. Is that true, John?
Yes, Dick. I picked one up about 4 years ago, slightly used, but completely refurbished. And as we all know, they are, you know, quite expensive. So if you can get one on a used basis, that's the way to go. And you know, be sure you get the elements. By the way, the elements are all interchangeable. There's different. There's one made by Coaxial Dynamics, and of course another made by birds themselves, and they're all interchangeable. And the main reason I got mine was that it gave me a lot of confidence by using the bird to keep an eye on my single sideband 756 Pro 3 with a lot of confidence, so to speak, and not having to worry about any other factors presented by other meters. That way, you know, it gives you a lot of confidence. And as you say, you have to be careful. But its value is extremely, it's really a professional meter that's used widely in the industry, as you know. Over to you, Dick, and say hello to the other gentleman there, Z2NBR.
Thank you again, John. KC2ZUM, I think that's Alan, and I think you've worked as a broadcast engineer. KC2ZUM, K2RAW. If I got the right guy, you've got it, Alan.
Yes, good evening, and good evening to the net, and good evening to John there, long time no speak. Both John and I worked at NBC and WPIX. I just wanted to say hello. I tried to check in earlier, but I've been listening. And for those of you that don't know, I'm no longer a resident of New York. I'm here in Orlando, Florida, going on, I'd say 2 months now. But got EchoLink up and running, and listen to the net here, and that's about it. So just wanted to say hello to everybody, and in case I do not, talk to you before the holidays. Wish everybody a holiday greeting and glad to hear that this net is still running. TechNet's been running a long time, and